On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we discuss the latest news, review recent ASCA advocacy activities, discuss recent false claims activities by the Department of Justice, and in our focus segment, discuss pharmacy issues with our newest sponsor, Alex Yampolsky from MedServe, and a panel of administrators.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, the longest-running podcast specifically focused on the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by MedServe, the only digital narcotic cabinet specifically designed and priced for surgery centers, helping standardize processes and compliance, eliminate paper logs, and prevent drug diversion. For more information about MedServe, visit MedServeRx.com. That's MedServeRx.com.
Welcome to episode 215 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for March 24th, 2024. Recording from our studios in Spencerport, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, co-host of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey and Operations Manager for Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. We would like to remind our listeners that the ASC regulatory environment is a rapidly evolving landscape, and the material presented in this episode is based on the most current information available as of the date of recording. As such, it is important to recognize that this information may be subject to change, and we advise all ASCs to stay up to date with the latest regulations and guidelines issued by the relevant regulatory bodies. Joining me today is John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the most respected experts in the ambulatory surgery industry. With over 30 years of experience, Mr. Gailey has authored over 10 books on the ASC industry, and he is a sought-after speaker on regulatory accreditation and finance issues.
So we're just finished up the Business Office Managers Boot Camp a couple weeks ago there, and then that was a great success. We're very excited about our collaboration with Christina Benton over at Coding Compliance Management. We had a lot of fun with that, and we are going to be going through some major changes, actually, with regard to our financial management education. We're going to develop a series of one-day conferences. So over the next 2 years, we've decided to create a whole series of different conferences to really kind of gear up education. We really feel that there isn't enough, you know, financial management education, specifically in the ambulatory surgery industry. So this boot camp helped us to understand, and, you know, talking to some of the attendees, you know, what we might be able to do to really enhance that education. So more to come on that. Also, we're going to be announcing this week the upcoming Director of Nursing Boot Camp, which is going to be in May, and the next Administrator's Boot Camp, which will be in July. So keep an eye out for that. And Sue, I was at one of our centers, our center in Memphis, Tennessee. I just had a wonderful trip out there. Absolutely gorgeous center. It's a combination surgery center and clinic. And they kind of breezed through a survey they had with AAHC, and want to thank my my colleagues out there for their great hospitality. And, you know, Sue, I was told by my colleagues at Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies that have visited there, what great food they have in Memphis, Tennessee. And unfortunately, I was so busy because you had scheduled, Sue is the operations manager, so she's in charge of my schedule. She had got me busy every night, so I wasn't able to actually have a nice, well, the one night I had a chance to go out, I couldn't find a restaurant, so it was kind of challenging. But I had Grubhub, and I had some great meals there. But
I know you're hoping for a nice barbecue. Yeah,
exactly.
Authentic place.
But Memphis was just wonderful, and it was great to see my colleagues at AAHC and to obviously have a very successful survey there. So, Sue, what's going on in the news world?
So I started with a couple things from ASCA and some of the ways that they're really advocating for ASCs. So ASCA submitted codes by the March 1st deadline in response to the ASC-covered procedures list. Pre-proposed rule recommendation request. And John, you can explain a little more about what that is.
Yeah, in the 2024 payment rule, CMS introduced a new way to submit codes for consideration. As you know, an ongoing issue that we've always had with CMS is trying to get new codes approved for Medicare reimbursement. And let's make something clear. When Medicare publishes the list of procedure codes for the next year, it authorizes payment for those procedures by Medicare. Now, surgery centers can do other cases that are not on the list of procedures that are paid for by Medicare. But that list becomes very important because it kind of sets a standard there. So this new pre-proposed rule recommendation request process, not very easy to say, by the way, is as I said, a new way to submit these codes. And ASC Association rolled that out, by the March 1st deadline. And these are these new codes are based upon feedback that ASCA has gotten from its members. So it's very important for all of your organizations out there who, wish to have new procedures added. Usually this is driven by the physicians to get that information to ASCA so they can advocate on your behalf.
And there were a couple of groups of codes that they requested, the cardiovascular codes, and I'm not going to read the codes, but I'll just tell you the basic categories. So under cardiovascular codes, electrophysiology studies and ablations, peripheral vascular diagnostic, and cardioversion and transesophageal echocardiogram. And as I said, there are a few codes under each of those. And then under spine codes, there's posterior lumbar interbody fusion and combined posterior lumbar and posterior lumbar interbody fusion. Don't know why those felt like a tongue twister.
Yeah, I know.
I must be tired. It's too late.
Well, and truthfully, these are not codes. These are not procedures that we're used to talking about in the ASC industry. Yeah. So we're going to have to get used to a whole new series of procedures here. Mm-hmm. And I think those cardiovascular, I think that is one of those areas that's really growing very fast right now. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, of course, we're asking for these procedures, but there are still some states, New York, for example, who do not allow the vast majority of these cardiovascular codes. And, the state association in New York is working. I know Pennsylvania just recently got it through. Mm-hmm. But keep in mind that you really need to know if your state is going to be allowed. Now, again, these have not been approved yet. They have gone to CMS for consideration.
And ASCA's National Advocacy Day was in February. So 76 ASCA members met with 161 members of Congress and their staff for National Advocacy Day in February. They spent time educating Congress about ASCs and encouraging them to support the Outpatient Surgery Quality and Access Act of 2023. So just to explain what that is, if enacted, this legislation would slow the widening disparity in Medicare payments between ASCs and hospital outpatient departments by making the hospital market basket the inflationary update factor permanently, add transparency and accessibility for patients trying to research quality metrics, require CMS to disclose the reasons procedures are denied reimbursement in the ASC setting. And I think that would be a good one because sometimes things are denied and we're really not sure why,
you know,
and so we don't even really know how to counter that. And add an ASC voice to the advisory panel on hospital outpatient payment. Meetings during National Advocacy Day have proven to have a direct impact on gaining new ASC supporters in Congress. Following last year's National Advocacy Day, three lawmakers signed on to the bill after meeting with constituents. So I know you've gone before, and it just from the pictures they always post, everybody looks like they're just really having a good time. And it's great to be able to, tell people about what we do.
Right.
That, maybe don't understand the quality and the cost savings that they can.
Yeah, and I did it a lot when I was an administrator before I got into this position. And I tried to get out there this year, but you kept me very busy during that week. But ASCA, of course, is a huge supporter of our industry and really has done some wonderful things. And I did talk to a number of people who participate, and they all said that they had a very favorable experience. And it's important to note there's quite a number of things that they kind of jumbled a whole bunch of things together in this one act, which is great. A couple things that are important is we know that MedPAC, which is who they're referring to when they're talking about the advisory panel, does not have anybody from the ASC industry on it. And that really hurts when it comes down to the ongoing analysis of activities of the Medicare surgery center. So, hopefully that's something we'll get resolved very quickly. Mm-hmm. And then I think The other issue that we've talked about quite a bit on the podcast over time is the use of the hospital market basket. In the past, we had used, or CMS had used, the CPI, and that really is not very reflective, or was not very reflective, of the true costs of in the ambulatory surgery industry, the healthcare industry in general. So that experiment is about to end, and ASCA is asking for that to be extended forever. So let's hope that these bills actually do get in front of Congress for a vote and hopefully get signed into law.
And Harris Beach attorneys sent out a legal alert on March 7th. We'll put a link to this in our show notes. And a lot of what I'm reading comes directly from that, and some I've summarized. The FCA permits private citizens to bring lawsuits as whistleblowers, also known as QI-TAM relators, alleging violations of the FCA against defendants, and they share a percentage of any recovery by the government, thereby creating substantial incentives for whistleblowers to assert claims of fraud against the government. In fiscal year 2023, the Department of Justice paid whistleblower plaintiffs nearly $350 million in connection with the resolution of FCA claims. And in 2023, the Department of Justice recovered almost $2.7 billion under the False Claims Act. The Department of Justice opened 500 new cases in 23, which is a 64% increase over 2022. This is also the highest number of non-whistleblower cases ever, meaning the Department of Justice likely has improved their ability to identify issues on their own. And a large number of cases were related to the Paycheck Protection Program, which could explain that high number in 2023.
So we've talked about this quite a bit during our conferences, how the False Claims Act is self-paid for. It is a program that is funded by the penalties that are levied against those organizations that are caught. And this is interesting. First of all, when you think about whistleblowers getting nearly $350 million. That is a heck of an incentive for people to blow in their former employers. Usually that's what happens, I think, or other people that get find out about what's going on in the organization. So, keep in mind that you really do need to encourage your employees to bring issues to your attention, before they go to the government. Not that anybody's doing anything wrong here in the ASC industry. We certainly hope that's not happening.
Yeah, we're definitely, I mean, obviously if somebody's doing something wrong, they need to have that addressed. But sometimes it's just something you didn't even realize you were doing wrong, or something that has that appearance of not being quite right. And you just have to be really on top of that right now.
Yeah, we actually talked about this quite a bit during the Business Office Managers Boot Camp because false claims, again, that whole point about making sure your employees feel very enabled to be able to bring things in front of you, even if you end up finding out that it was, not any fraud situation or a false claim, but you really want to encourage them to do that before they go to the government. Even if somebody goes to the government and then end up winning and it wasn't a false claim, of course, that fight in itself is very complex.
Yeah,
so yet another reason to keep on top of that.
Yeah. So Harris Beach listed some of the major areas cited, and these include Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE fraud, inaccurate diagnosis code reporting under Medicare Advantage, Medicare Part C, knowing submission of inaccurate information or knowing failure to correct inaccurate information, unnecessary services and tests, kickbacks, substandard care, billing improprieties, claims related to the opioid epidemic. The epidoid is my new word for the opioid epidemic. Some of the Department of Justice's top priorities in 2024 will be cybersecurity fraud, COVID-19 pandemic relief fraud, healthcare fraud, such as financial inducements to provide referrals, nursing home fraud, and claims against private equity firms and other third parties that cause the submission of false claims, such as coding and billing consultants, if they are improperly inflating payments by upcoding or other unsupported claims. Some suggestions from Harris Beach are to carefully review the False Claims Act enforcement activity, keep your compliance programs current, and be sure they're functioning properly. Also, when you are making decisions based on ambiguous or hard to understand guidance, document your decision process so that if you do have a problem later, it can be helpful, you know, answering questions and explaining why you did this, that this was your reasoning, and this is why you thought it was okay.
And that way they're at least arguing against your decision-making process rather than your failure to actually address it.
Yep.
So this is very interesting. And by the way, I do want to, put a word in for Harris Beach. I've worked with them over the years. They're a wonderful firm, and that's why we chose to take one of their legal articles out, because we know they do a great job. You know, my biggest concern, I think, right now has to do with kickbacks. We've been very concerned that people might unknowingly make payments to medical directors or to individuals in the organization that really fall into the kickback category. So be very careful with that. And Sue, I know our clients are getting tired of hearing me say this, but hire a good lawyer, you know, to look at all of your agreements and any arrangements that you might have. And these happen, you know, literally every day. You know, you hire a medical director to work on your organization. You bring somebody in to, you know, as another director in your organization, you just have to make sure those payments are very reasonable and are not actually a kickback. The other thing I do want to mention, another thing I want to emphasize is how Harris Beach kind of talked about the importance of making sure your compliance program is working well. So two things there. First of all, make sure you have a corporate compliance program in place in your organization. Make sure you're educating your employees on an annual basis about the contents of that corporate compliance plan. Make sure you have a corporate compliance officer, that's knowledgeable about that plan and that you actually do the things that are written into the corporate compliance plan. One thing that I've noted, especially as a surveyor, is that when I read through the corporate compliance plans, it has all these provisions like doing, you know, periodic coding audits, for example, or business office audits, or looking at claims on a quarterly basis. And so often I find that the business office manager, the administrator, doesn't even know the contents of the corporate compliance plan. So number one, make sure you have one. Number two, make sure you actually follow through on that. And that will definitely help you with avoiding healthcare fraud. So we all know that drug diversion is on the rise in surgery centers across the country, and because so many ambulatory surgery centers use, kind of old-fashioned key lock cabinets and paper drug logs to secure and track their controlled substances, that really does put them at risk for many, many issues. And they are becoming prime targets for DEA inspections. And of course, as we mentioned, drug diversion is a thing now. And, you know, if it hasn't happened to you yet, you know, there's a good chance it's going to happen. We find it happening, unfortunately, not irregularly, throughout the industry. So I did have a chance to have a panel discussion with our newest sponsor, Alex Yampolsky with MedServe, and a panel of administrators, including our own employee, who was a former administrator, Katie Pearson. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll listen to that panel discussion.
Running the surgery center is stressful enough. Worrying about drug diversion shouldn't be a part of it. We've all been there, stressing out and frantically searching for that misplaced narcotic key, trying to decipher those messy paper logs, or worse yet, investigating an inventory discrepancy on a Friday night. Key locked cabinets and paper logs are a thing of the past. That's why we've created MedServe. MedServe is the only digital narcotic cabinet and management system built specifically for surgery centers. With MedServe, there are no more keys, no more messy paper logs. Your narcotics are secured digitally, easily tracked, and reports and logs are accessible with a click of a button, giving you complete control and peace of mind. Best of all, MedServe is designed to fit seamlessly into your existing workflow, saving you time and reducing stress. It's time to modernize your center. It's time to get a MedServe. Visit MedServeRx.com to learn more.
So I'm here with our newest sponsor from MedServe, Alex Yampolsky, and Scott Nation from Velocity Surgical Management, and Katie Pearson from Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. And we're going to talk about pharmacy for a while today, the issue of pharmacy and pharmaceutical services and all the challenges that we have with pharmacy has really been a topic that we've talked about quite a bit. So today I thought we would just talk a little bit about some of the challenges and risks that are facing surgery centers around medication and narcotic management. So welcome to my esteemed panel here. I'm going to start with you, Alex. Alex, what do you think is some of the biggest challenges that surgery centers face right now in pharmacy?
Oh, man. We see it all. So from key management to the narcotic cabinet. So kind of to back up a little bit, what we see in health, in hospital systems is we have Omnicells and Pyxis, we have really tight pharmacy controls. And then when we step into the world of surgery centers, it's like we traveled back in time. We're using locked cabinets, we're using keys, we're using paper logs, we're using tackle boxes or lock boxes or fanny packs or whatever else for anesthesia, and then more paperwork in the operating room. And that just creates so many headaches and so many opportunities for mistakes or drug diversion. Not to mention that in the surgery center, just the way the financials work out, there's just not enough resources to dedicate to a pharmacy personnel who is the expert of all of those things. And typically a nurse takes on the pharmacy nurse job, and that's just one extra thing she has to do or he has to do. And again, that just opens the center up to a lot of issues.
Yeah, Katie, I'm actually going to turn to you now as an administrator and a nurse. Of course, you work for Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies right now, but before that, you were administrator of a couple surgery centers. Can you kind of talk about some of the challenges that you faced in managing the pharmacy area in your surgery centers?
Yeah, it really is bizarre, is the best word I can use, moving from a hospital system to the surgery center environment. Where you're right, a step back in time is a great way to describe it. And the lack of regulation that seems to exist. Now, in Texas, luckily, we were required to have a pharmacy consultant come on a weekly basis.
See, I don't know if I would call that luckily. That is a huge burden on surgery centers in that state. But it definitely keeps you on your toes there.
Yeah, it almost made you feel warm and fuzzy knowing that there was someone else monitoring what was going on because of how sensitive medication management or narcotics are out there, and specifically hearing about the drug diversion uptick that seems to be going on. So it's nice not being the only one, you know, looking at that or being responsible for it, I guess, at the end of the day you are, but it's nice having someone who's an expert who kind of knows what to look for and can have those hard conversations as well with some of the staff. So, you know, it is a lot though. And it's not only from the nurses counting or, you know, managing, you know, the numbers, but it's also ordering the medications. And then, you know, when there's shortages, trying to sell your soul to get some more drugs. And then also with anesthesia, you know, helping them understand why you have to manage it also in an ambulatory surgery center, because they seem sometimes to get a little lax in how they're practicing with the drugs. So there's a multifaceted needs in this arena in the surgery center. And you're right, having a nurse being the one trying to figure it all out can be really challenging, especially if they have no idea what they're doing either. So they're kind of just learning on the fly and trying to figure it out. So it is a challenge.
I just want to jump in quick, a couple comments, Katie, that you made. The pharmacist visits. So like I appreciate you saying, I'm a pharmacist by training. So I appreciate you saying the warm and fuzzies of having somebody else kind of looking over everything with you. From what we see around the country, it's anything from weekly visits in Texas to twice a year visit somewhere else in other states. So it's a very diverse how what's required state by state. And the level of service that different pharmacists provide is also very different. So we've worked with pharmacists that literally just check the box of I've been here. And, you know, the minimum requirements, whatever. And then we have pharmacists that are putting on seminars, doing newsletters, educating. There's just a big gap between some of the pharmacists out there, the good and the kind of the bad, or the, I guess, bare minimum.
I fired my first pharmacist that was at my facility because I didn't think they were up to par with the quality that should have been conducted. So I can fully appreciate that. Luckily, there's other options in my area that I could choose from. But yeah, it is something to be mindful of, as well as the level of quality service they are giving you. It's a great call out.
I'm going to bring Scott into the conversation also. Scott, first of all, introduce yourself because you're not known to our audience yet. So go ahead.
Sure. Scott Nation, president of Velocity Surgical Management. We're based out of Nashville, Tennessee. We develop, manage, partner with physicians around the country to run outpatient surgery centers.
So, Scott, you how many centers do you manage?
Between management and development now, we're 10 or 11. I have to look. We've got another one coming on board right now.
So talk about some of the challenges that your centers have and how pharmacy consultants, I think that's an interesting theme that we're seeing here is the importance of pharmacy consultants and how they can help the organization.
Yeah, like Katie, I started in the hospital system for about 12 years. Then I've been in the surgery center space for about 20 and was the surgery center administrator myself 20 years ago, opened the first center about that long ago. And then I've managed several around the country. I think the challenges too, and, you know, I get away from the clinical piece of it to the financial piece. You see, I hate to say it, but with the Alex and Katie's point, there is vast differences in quality of pharmacy consultant. And I think, and that ties to cost as well. And I don't know if it's as much quality as how much time does this person have, because you're trying to get a consultant that may be working at a Walgreens or maybe working at a hospital full time. They have a full time job typically. I think you are getting more, especially in concentrated markets, that maybe this is their only job. And I've seen just huge, variances in expense to a center. And if you're a smaller center, can you afford one of these pharmacy consultants that's going to be there and do the training with the staff because of the price point they charge? Is unfortunately, you get what you pay for it in some instances. So they're charging quite a bit more, but you're getting a lot more services, which a lot of facilities need. But it is a challenge, I think, everywhere, because, there's a gamut of issues that go along with narcotic diversion. The number one is patient safety. Is this person that's diverting, are they using during work hours? The other thing is the patient's not getting the medication they need to have a positive outcome. And to me, that is a huge issue. Are they not being sedated properly? Are they not being pain controlled and recovery properly because somebody is diverting medications? And most centers we had, at best we had, it's typically a camera in the area of medication, but it doesn't see everything and you can still open up and put meds down. It helped, from gross diversion. Somebody taking a whole box, you could see that. But before as who did what and when the problem was, if you have an incorrect count, which everyone does in this system, you have an incorrect count, what do you do? We've kept staff, 2 hours at the end of the day at times and did chart audit, especially if you had a busy day and 40, 50 cases, where was that incorrect count or when did some patient get extra? So besides honest issues that can cause a nightmare with narcotics, you have the drug diversion, that's obviously worse. But when you're going through this on a day, you don't know which one it was when you're trying to figure out an incorrect count. And you're thinking, oh my gosh, I hope I don't have somebody in this building that is diverting drugs.
Alex, I'm going to bounce back to you for a second here because, we have about 85 clients in Ambitor Healthcare Strategies across the country. And I think we've had, Katie helped me with this, like 4 or 5 suspected diversions or actual diversions in the last 18 months, if I remember right.
Absolutely.
And interestingly, just last month, I actually had a board meeting this last week where there was a miscount. And unfortunately, the organization didn't follow up immediately on this. Now, they did, eventually, but they didn't follow up immediately on this. And during the board meeting, the medical director was unaware of the situation. So Alex, what do you think about that situation? Obviously, the first thing I recommend as soon as you hear that you've got a miscount is call your pharmacy consultant, get them involved in it, figure out whether this is a reportable event, to DEA, et cetera. But again, I think it points to the importance and the advantages of having somebody that you can call, on a moment's notice.
Yeah, I think so. You have your regular discrepancy things with when you keep your staff for 2 hours, like Scott was mentioning. Afterwards, you can dig through your logs, you can dig through your charts, and you can figure it out. But if you can't, then you definitely have to call somebody else in who can maybe knows more, has seen more, has had more experience with it. And the sooner you act, the more likely you are to recover it, to find it, to have the proper documentation. And then, like, God forbid you actually get DEA involved, and whatever gaps could be found, like, the faster you act, the better. It is important to have those people you can call when something does happen, in my opinion and experience.
Yeah, Scott's point was very important. He kept those people, and I've not always seen that. You know, I mean, that's one of the things that I want to get across to our audience right now is that the only way you can really resolve these things is to act on it right away, until such time as you can determine, you know, you determine that you're not going to find whatever, you know, miscount was occurred.
You know, just to jump in real quick, sure. We also hear, like, sometimes you can keep people after work. Sometimes you can't. I mean, everybody's got life, kids, you know, whatever responsibilities. But the other thing that we hear a lot, too, is the anesthesia team, the CRNA or anesthesiologist, done for the day, tosses in the tackle box and out the door they go. And then something doesn't add up. You have to call them. You have to call them back in. So it could be a lot more problematic.
Yeah, and I think the point being is that you act on it right away, even if it's just coming up with an action plan, you know, to deal with it the next day.
Yeah, I think anything on a miscount, you need to address it within 24 hours. I mean, we're talking about narcotics here. There are several things, like I said, could be the issue, could be honest mistake, could be diversion.
Right.
We always look at it. You have to address it within 24 hours and definitely notify your medical director. I mean, if you cannot resolve the issue, you know, if you resolve it and realize, hey, this patient got an extra one, you know, somebody. And that's the thing, too, with the MedServe system. If somebody forgets to chart it because they're in a hurry, I mean, we get busy. Surgery centers are fast paced. You know, you're trying to provide fast paced, proficient care, efficient care. And sometimes somebody's like, oh, let me get this. I need another one for, hey, can you write it down for me? The nurse is, OR nurse maybe is getting it. But that's the thing, too. You might have one nurse that's in charge of narcotic keys, but I've seen it, and I'm sure Katie has as well. OR nurse, hey, I need the narcotic keys. I can get something out from Ms. Simpson. Or, you know, it's you try to obviously keep it between your nursing staff, but rarely how the day flows and, you know, your narcotic nurse, whoever's in charge, they're pre-op in a patient or they're recovering someone. Hey, here's the keys, you know, so go ahead and get that fentanyl out for Miss Simpson. That happens and people get in a hurry. And I think mistakes happen when people are in a hurry and when it's a busy day, and it's just human nature, but you have to find that and correct it as soon as possible.
To piggyback off of what Scott is saying, it kind of just helps highlight some of the nuances that an ASC has to deal with, in that they don't have the resources necessarily as readily available as a hospital does when something like this happens. And it's trying to figure out in a very quick time, because two ASCs close, you know, they're not open 24 hours a day. So it's trying to get it all done within this very defined timeline. And with the staff that you have, and even consulting with your medical director, a lot of the times I found that they didn't know necessarily how to handle it. So I had to reach out to someone like John's company or ask her or someone like that to say, hey, this has happened. Anybody ever have something like this occur? So it's an interesting challenge when these things happen.
Yeah. And so the things with counts, we see that all the time where, you know, with a paper log, it's so easy. You look at the logs, it says 19, you count 18, but you count 19 in your head. And it's kind of like leading the witness. So part of it, like, and, you know, in MedServe, when we designed the product, we were very mindful about having instant notifications to the administrator or director of nursing when there is a discrepancy, because the system hides the count from the nurse. So she doesn't know that she's supposed to count 18. So she can count 19, she can count 17. But if it's off, the manager will get notified. And that's just to that whole timeliness, because when you catch it at the end of the day, or worse yet, it'll just snowball over a few days, a week, when you actually then end up figuring it out and then trying to peel that back and unwind it to where it happened. That's hours of stress and labor.
Alex, I want to go back to something. You know, we've read some articles lately. It seems like almost every other episode of the podcast, we've been talking about drug diversion and people that have been, you know, accused of it or convicted of it. How big a problem is this nationally? I know you've got a good, you know, sense of the pulse of this industry, but is this something that ASC administrators need to worry about? I mean, I told you the story that we've had, you know, 4 to 5 diversions or suspected diversions in the last 18 months. It sounds to me like a major problem.
So the statistics are kind of crazy. Like, it's hard to put numbers on this because who really admits to stealing drugs? But the statistics say that in healthcare in general, 9 out of 10 cases of the drug diversion are not discovered. Oh. Nobody ever knows. And the implications, I know Scott was mentioning earlier, kind of like, is the patient getting the right medication? Are they under sedated? Are they, do they have saline instead of fentanyl? Yeah. But we also see cases where people die off of that when there's contaminations. Like we just saw that, I think in Oregon, there was a hospital where 9 patients died because a nurse was swapping fentanyl with saline. So like patients' lives are actually at risk. Those cases don't happen very frequently. But there's a lot that does that we just don't know about. And I know, Scott, you and I at some point had talked about how, in your personal experience, I think you were telling me that maybe you only catch 1 out of 7 cases, like from what you've seen from your years in the industry.
Maybe, yes. And I've actually had centers where we have caught nurses and caught one physician over the years as well. That's even worse than dealing with a miscount, having to deal when you actually catch someone. And I mean, because that person needs help for one thing,
right?
You have to address it from that, but they're not safe to take care of patients if they've been doing that. And typically what we found out when we quiz these people and look back, it had been going on for a while. We did not catch them at the first time they did this. You know, I would say when you catch someone, you're catching 1 out of 7, maybe 1 out of 8 or 9, like you said, Alex. But when you catch the person, typically, you know, you're looking at, has it been going on 6 months, 9 months, 12 months? And I know that's hard to believe, but typically that's the scenario.
Yeah. And there was a very popularized example with a fertility center, I believe in Connecticut, that became a podcast on Apple. They made, or it was a podcast, and I know it was like number one on Apple for a while. Basically made it into like a murder mystery 4-series or 5-series podcast about fertility clinic where a nurse was taking fentanyl, using it in the clinic initially herself, then taking it home and using it at home and bringing back empty vials, and basically patients, women going through egg retrievals with no pain medicine on board. Like it went on for a very long time. She admitted to a certain period of time, but patient cases date back way longer. Sometimes it is the person you least suspect. It's the person who's your right-hand person. It's the person who's responsible for it, who's always taken on more responsibility. And they're the ones who find the opportunity because there's nobody looking over them. And they are the person looking over everything else. That's what happened in that case. In my personal experience, when I was a little baby pharmacist, just getting out of school, my mentor at a pharmacy I was working at was kind of the right-hand man to the manager, ended up overseeing a lot of the operations. Lo and behold, when I got into administrative work and became director of operations, we ended up catching him. Yeah. He stole 120,000 Vicodins, 3,000 oxycodone 30s, and a whole bunch of Valium that he admitted to because we had data to prove it. God knows how long this has been going on. When I was looking at his patterns, I remember being a student and seeing, why does this guy have a backpack in the pharmacy? Why does he use the back door to leave? Yeah. Like never like connected the dots because you trust the person. He's the authority. And there wasn't a system in place to catch that until we implemented one. And then boom, over 3 months, 120,000 Vicodins.
Alex, that is such an important point that you bring up about it's the person you least expect to occur. That has happened over and over again, in my career, 35 years in this, that all of those diversions were not people, that you would have thought would have diverted it. Katie, I want to kind of delve into the paperwork side of it. You having come from the hospital side and then over to the ASC side, what did you think of our antiquated paper systems that we have?
Yeah, taking a trip back in time for sure. I fought it every day saying there's got to be a better way to do this. As soon as I saw that we were tracking everything on paper again in the ASC setting. So I did not enjoy it. I didn't like that was the method that was being done, because to Alex's point, the numbers are right there. Everything's right there in front of you. And if you mess up, it's fine. Yeah. That's what it was. So that's right. You know, like there was no real check and balance there other than a second human being standing there correcting your work, which it's like human error versus human error at the end of the day. So I'm not a fan of, you know, relying on two human beings writing down on a piece of paper one of the most important aspects of your surgery center. That's my opinion.
And a lot of times, what I don't know if in your experience what it's been like, I mean, John, you probably don't get to see this because people are probably on their best behavior around you, but a lot of the witnessing that has to happen doesn't happen because people trust each other. They work together for a long time. And it's like, hey, can you sign off on this? I took this an hour ago. I didn't have time. And like to Scott's point, like, here are the keys. I'm busy. It's an honor system.
Yeah, you're right there, Alex. And fortunately, it is. Hey, oh man, I had to grab that. No one was around. Hey, Betty, come sign this. I took it out about 30 minutes ago. You know, I gave it to them, you know, draw up the anesthesiologist or the CRNA. But legibility, I mean, it's like you can typically tell a lot of times, like when we've had to go back, when we've had over the years and issues like, all right, they say they got one out, but who's the patient? Who wrote this? We've had pain management centers where we're running a few ORs and we may do 60 cases in a day, 60, 70 cases. I managed a center years ago in the Northeast. It was 5-6 ORs, 3 procedure rooms. There's days we would do 100, 110 cases in that facility. And you're like, and if you figure out you got an issue at the end of the day there, man, the chart audit. To your point earlier, you're not keeping everyone after that day to figure it out. But when do you do it? Because you may have that same amount of cases the next morning. Are you bringing in additional nurses or do you have the nurses, or are you staying there as the administrator, you know, all night trying to track down the issue? Because it has to be taken seriously.
Yeah, Alex, you were telling me that people are on their best behavior during a survey, but I can give you an example of a situation where I was doing a survey and the nurse came to me and said, you know, John, the drug count has been signed off for the entire day. And I said, that's interesting. It's only 11 o'clock in the morning. And when she went to the log, a physician, an anesthesiologist, had already signed off the evening count. And this is with a surveyor there. But you could tell, I mean, it was just something that they do every day. You know, somebody just felt, hey, listen, I'll trust the nurse there. So if that system is not in place, if people don't take that seriously, because we make it so easy with paper records, you know, then we got a problem. I mean, Katie, yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, paperwork can be a lot more troublesome, but on the other hand, it's so much easier to, you know, to fill things out without that check and balance that we expect with this. Now, Alex, I want, you know, of course, you've got a product out there, and you know, we're trying to be very careful about making sure that we're agnostic to the different systems. But let's face it, there aren't a lot of systems that have been developed in the surgery center space. We all know about Pyxis, and of course, Pyxis is really designed for much larger, you know, centers for surgery, you know, for especially for hospitals. And quite frankly, they don't translate particularly well into the ASC space, which is, I think, one of the reasons that we haven't seen, you know, computerization or, you know, centralized systems like that developed. Can you talk a little bit, including your own product, but, you know, about that move toward an electronic version or electronic tracking of drugs now, what the state of that is in the ASC industry?
I think a lot of people are really interested in it. From the conversations I have, I'd say maybe only 1 in 5 will think that their process is fine.
Yeah, good point.
Many people have considered it before and just got shut down because who's going to be able to afford a Pyxis or an Omnicell?
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that people know about, right? And then there's like a few other ones that are maybe for long-term care or maybe some other like hospital one that, again, it's just like it's not a right fit, it's too big, or it's just doesn't work well.
Or the source administration. I mean, I had a client who had a Pyxis in the surgery center, which was great. The problem was it was so complicated to run that the computer that ran it was unpassword protected in a side room. In other words, you could have overridden the whole system. The whole purpose behind the system was gone because they had they made it so easy to access the computer that controlled the Pyxis unit.
Mm-hmm. And you know, that's kind of like that's the place that lands. So this is like this is the reason why our company has become and our product has become so popular now. And I mean, all throughout the country, people know about us already. And we're built for surgery center workflows, which is not can't be said for anything else out there. And the size of it, the functionality, and the ease of use from going away from the paper world. So many people are interested in that, and there aren't many solutions out there to do that. There are a couple companies that do digital logging of just the narcotic logs. But it doesn't secure the product. But there we are seeing a lot of people interested in it, but feeling defeated throughout their 25-year, 30-year careers, that there's just really nothing out there and they can't afford what is. But, you know, I want to hear what Katie and Scott have to say on this, because I'm obviously very biased.
Well, and Katie, I want to focus on you're the person in the company that keeps like shoving us toward technology. we laugh because she's gung ho for it, and of course there's this old people like myself who I'm getting up there in years, and it's a little bit harder to transition to these things. But we know this is coming, right, Katie? We know we have to, and we also know we have to put it into high gear, because if we don't, we're going to be behind the eight ball. So talk a little bit about how surgery centers, you know, a couple of things, how surgery centers need to start transitioning to that. And then probably the more important thing, Katie, how do you sell it to the owners?
Yeah, well, you called it out. So I won't say any of that. So it's exactly, maybe not exactly, but very similar to implementing EMRs, right? Where it's not necessarily required in the ASC space, yet everyone is seeing the benefit and the necessity of it as we move into this, you know, 2024, yeah. the year that it is, and folks coming from hospital systems who are expecting it. They're expecting the technology to be present in their surgery center to safeguard them, to safeguard their patients. So that is always one piece of, you know, that I'll use to try to sell my stakeholders on is, you know, if you want to get the best of the best, you got to have the best as well. And then also, you know, just again, selling them on that it's the right thing to do for your patients. It's the right thing to do in regards to processes. And, you know, thankfully MedServ does offer an option that is affordable. And, you know, if you don't want to be the next news story of a drug diversion, this would be a really smart thing to do. So I think there's enough out there to sell it. You do need someone who's passionate about it, someone that will take it on, just like the EMR, implementing it, managing it, understanding it. However, I do believe that at the end of the day, not only will it save you time on trying to track things down if something was to go awry, but then also giving your staff that again, warm and fuzzy feeling that something else is there managing the system. So
Scott, you indicated that you do a lot of startups or, you know, de novo type projects also, I'm assuming. So talk about, the best time to set up a system the right way, of course, is before you even have a system in the first place. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, exactly. So to your point, like any new center we do, we're going to have an EMR out of the gate. Like Katie said, hey, this didn't used to be the case, but. And we're going to have it in the cloud. You know, everybody has always had these servers sitting in the closet, and you know, you have to worry about those. And if something goes wrong with it, you know, you're out of luck. So just like the medication piece of it, this has been a long time coming. I mean, I got in the hospital space in 92, and we had Pyxis then. I mean, really, ideally, we should have had an alternative, to Pyxis for the ASC space then.
Yeah.
So it's, and I remember when I left the hospital space, probably kind of like Katie, and went into the surgery center space, I'm like, now, how are we tracking medications? How are we tracking narcotics? And it's like, oh yeah, here's a clipboard. And you got a double lock, and one locks your cabinets above, you know, your pre-op or wherever they are, that a 5-year-old could get into that first one to get to the box. But so it is mandatory. Like, we're not going to open any new centers, you know, without at least MedServe. You know, if doctors want to look at another option, we would. But I think the great thing about MedServe is, well, Alex mentioned it earlier, as soon as they're an incorrect count, you might see, it might happen at 10 in the morning. You're not trying to find it at 5 p.m. when you're done with the cases. That notification goes to your clinical director, whoever you have set up as the administrator. So that piece is like any issue, especially a narcotic miscount or diversion issue, when you can discover it real time versus the end of the day, or what if you're doing cases tomorrow that don't require narcotics? And then, I've seen that. It's like, you know, everybody's closed up shop the end of the day on Monday. No one caught it. Then you do your counts the next day you're open for cases, or next morning, and then it's caught. Then you're that's even more of an issue. So I think the big thing is, with MedServe, you know, in real time when a count is incorrect, so you can address it immediately.
Scott, I want to bounce back to you on this whole issue about how do we sell, technology such as what we've been talking about here, to owners of surgery centers. You work with, obviously, de novo projects, as we mentioned before, as well as, centers that you take on. How do you sell that to them?
Yeah, so typically when we're putting the package together for the centers, we include the EMR, all the technology we can in our proposals to do these centers. And I think a lot of times the physicians look to us as to guide them in what they should be doing. But if, you know, they start asking about an EMR, we give them all the benefits of the EMR. They start asking about having a more advanced, system to secure and track narcotics. It's, I think we've seen more and more of the issues. It's, they don't want to be a headline. They don't want to have the DEA coming in. That, we have enough issues, with regulation and keeping things on the straight and narrow. So it's typically not a hard sell for them, because I think we've all seen some type of issue over the years. So out of the gate, it's a little easier than adding it to a center that thinks, they're the one, that 1 in 5, like Alex mentioned earlier, that thinks their process is okay, which if you're using a paper log, it's definitely not. But it's this, the value proposition, and it's proving to telling them, hey, it's not going to slow down our process. It's going to make you more efficient, and we're going to make sure that these medications are getting to the patients more timely versus possible diversion.
Alex, I'll bounce back to you. I'd kind of end with the value, again, repeating the value of having a pharmacist and how important it is from a legal standpoint and a patient safety standpoint to have a good pharmacist involved and to have them part of this whole process here, especially the paperwork.
Yeah, so the customers we worked with who've had issues in the past, having the right pharmacist set up the procedures and policies in place before anything ever happens. So you have a complete, game book or playbook as to, here's what you need to do when something happens. These pharmacists will come in and they'll do in services about red flags, like things you should look, be on the lookout with your colleagues, or things that you may be seeing that but hey, bring it up. So I think it's very, very helpful, because when something does happen, they can follow that playbook and they can act really fast, and then they can bring in the right resource to help them out. And versus being completely kind of on their own and trying to navigate this out themselves, because this could be the first time they're doing it themselves. This may be the first time the administrator or director of nursing has to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And on the worst case of things is if you don't have the right policies in place, things can happen in the most ideal situation. Still, there's still probably ways to get around them. But if you don't have the right procedures and policies in place, you're going to be looked at as a negligent operator, and then you're in a whole world of trouble. And, you know, we've heard something from one of the administrators who said, look, my nurses can go get a job somewhere else, but if I get my DA license pulled, my surgeons cannot operate. They're just out of luck. I'm out of luck. Like the center, like it's a big deal. And if you're found negligent because you didn't think it was a big deal, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. So it's really important to have the right people around you, whether it's the right compliance people, the right pharmacy people, just having the right team. I think that just supercharges you.
And I think that's a good way to end. You know, I want to thank all of you. This has been great. You know, I think pharmacy has really kind of skyrocketed to become one of the major issues that we deal with from a compliance, regulatory compliance standpoint. And I think you gave a very good overview of it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
In this segment, we provide an update on upcoming topics for the podcast, our upcoming virtual conferences, and upcoming speaking engagements for John and his staff and other events in the ASC industry.
So the Florida Society of Ambulatory Surgical Centers Quality and Risk Management Conference is April 4th to the 5th in Daytona Beach, Florida at the Hilton Oceanfront Resort. And their annual conference and trade show is July 17th through the 19th. In Orlando, Florida, at the Signia by Hilton Orlando Bonnet Creek.
ASCA 2024 will be at the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center in Orlando, Florida, April 17th through the 20th. A bunch of us will be there.
That's right. We're very excited about getting out there. Hopefully do at least two podcasts if we can from there. I'll be speaking. I'm doing a panel discussion and at one point, and then I'm doing a speech on doing financial projections, which we've never really talked about before at ASCA. So I'm very excited about that. Not to mention this Gaylord. I love the Gaylords. You know, they are just so huge, and they look like the outside on the inside. You don't even have to go outside. So it'll be a lot of fun. And hopefully we'll see you all there. And certainly, you know, text me or email me if you're coming, and let us know that you're going to be there.
And the Arizona Ambulatory Surgery Center Association Conference is April 27th through the 28th in Scottsdale, Arizona at the Westin Careland Resort.
The Gulf States Conference is June 11th through the 13th in Biloxi, Mississippi at the Beau Rivage Resort and Casino.
Becker's Spine Orthopedic and Pain Management Driven ASC Conference is June 19th through the 22nd in Chicago at the Swiss Hotel.
And the Texas Ambulatory Surgery Center Society's annual conference is July 24th through the 26th in Galveston, Texas at the San Luis Resort, Spa, and Conference Center.
The Georgia Society of ASCs and South Carolina ASC Association's joint semi-annual conference and trade show is August 15th and 16th in Hilton Head, South Carolina at the Marriott Hilton Head Resort and Spa.
The California Ambulatory Surgery Association's annual conference is September 4th through the 6th in Anaheim, California, at the Anaheim Marriott.
The Tennessee Ambulatory Surgery Center Association's annual conference is September 12th and 13th in Chattanooga, Tennessee, at the Chattanoogan.
And the Becker's ASC 30th annual meeting, entitled The Business and Operations of ASCs, is October 30th through November 2nd in Chicago, Illinois, at the Hyatt Regency. And we'll be announcing shortly the upcoming ASC Director of Nursing Boot Camp in May and the ASC Administrators Boot Camp in July. And on-demand versions of our boot camps are available at our ASC-Central website. For more information, go to asc-central.com. And don't forget about our patron program. The patron program, also known as ASC Central, is an exclusive membership website that provides a one-stop ASC regulatory and accreditation, compliance, operations, and financial management resource for all of those busy administrators, nurse managers, and business office managers. And resources include some of our virtual conferences, links to various resources, policies and procedures, forms, fire and disaster drills, as well as our very well-known weekly drop-in sessions, usually on Saturday mornings, where you have an opportunity for an hour on Saturday mornings to meet with the hosts of the ASC podcast, as well as some of the surveyors that are on the Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies team. And membership in the program helps to defray the costs of producing the podcast, including our research staff, travel costs to conferences, equipment costs, and production costs. And for more information, please visit asc-central.com.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. If you found this episode informative, we encourage you to share it with your friends and colleagues in the ASC industry. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you'll never miss an episode. We would love any feedback about our episode or ideas for future episodes by sending us an email at comments@ascpodcast.com.
And we'd like to give a special thank you to our great team here who make this podcast possible. Our sound editor is, of course, Sue Cronkite, our executive producer, John Gailey, and our dedicated research team of Sue Cronkite, Jenna Alvarez, Judy D'Ambrosio, Michael D'Ambrosio, Alex Morneman, Zach Kalritis, Jim Masters, Amy Cronkite, Lori Rodericks, Kathy Fody, Donna Macchio, Christina Norman, and Katie Pearson. We certainly couldn't do it without them. And our music is provided by Media Sushi and Mike Noah, and the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is hosted on Podbean and is available on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening. This episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is sponsored by MedServe, which offers the only digital narcotic cabinet specifically designed and priced for surgery centers, helping standardize processes and compliance, eliminate paper logs, and prevent drug diversion. For more information about our sponsor, visit MedServeRx.com. That's MedServeRx.com. This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute, legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development. All rights are reserved. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. And we'd love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.